As Charmaine said, if you were around earlier in the year, you'll probably remember that we had a series on the first six chapters of Daniel. And I had a conversation with her around that time. And it went something like this. I said, well, how come everyone chooses to preach in the first six chapters of Daniel and then stops there? You know, it's almost like they leave the rest because they just think it's a little bit difficult. You know, I reckon it's about time that we should do the second bit of it as well. So anyway, I remember the day well. It was the day before Easter. And she said to me very casually, I've just done the preaching rota for next term, and I've just sent it to you. And she had a little smile on her face, but stupidly, I didn't think a lot of it. So I got back to the office and checked my emails, looked at the email, of course. What are we going to do, the back end of this summer term? Yes, the last book of the last bit of Daniel. And whose name's down to preach on it? Yep, yep, yours truly. So that'll teach me to open my big mouth. But the good news is that there's a rare treat in store for you, as we're now going to spend the remainder of this term looking at the seldom preached on second half of the book of Daniel. So, you know, I may say that with my tongue in a little bit in my cheek, but I do hope that it will prove a rare treat. Because, you know, too often we stick to the bits of the Bible that we know. So I think it's great to look at the bits that are less familiar, because wherever you look, there's always treasure there. And nowhere is this more true than in the book of Daniel. I also hope that when we get into it, we'll see that actually it isn't really that difficult after all. Yeah, there's lots of dreams and visions with beasts flying everywhere and stacks of numbers which don't make a lot of sense at first sight. But the thing is that if you don't get bogged down in every last detail, you should find it relatively easy to grasp the big picture of what's going on. Now, my rule of thumb for reading Daniel actually comes right at the end of the book. Don't turn to it now, but if you go all the way to verse 8 of chapter 12, what you see there is Daniel himself saying, "I heard, but I did not understand." So if he didn't understand everything, it's highly unlikely that we're going to understand everything either. So when you're reading Daniel, don't give yourself the challenge of trying to grasp every last detail. The key to looking at it is always to see the big picture. And if we keep this big picture in mind, I'm sure we'll find it both accessible and highly relevant as we work our way through the next 6 weeks. So, as far as today goes, we're in chapter 7. Now, chapter 7 is really important, as it both brings an end to the first half of the book, and also it sets the scene for the second half. So what I'm going to do is start by explaining the context of it all, and then finish by working through the chapter itself. Because it's important to see there are important points in both those two areas, the context and the detail. So just first, though, a recap of where we got to in the first six chapters. The setting is the 6th century BC, and Daniel's been part of the first group of exiles of the Israelites who've been exiled to Babylon. And along with his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, who become better known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Daniel's been chosen to serve the king, Nebuchadnezzar. We see that in chapter 1. And what it appears is that he actually spends the rest of his life in Babylon. He's certainly there when it falls to the Medo-Persians. And it's clear that he's also there for a little while afterwards. So Daniel probably never got back to Israel. And although he served successive governments in Babylon with distinction, and he's given special wisdom and a gift in interpretation of dreams and riddles, for him, life is far from plain sailing. And both he and his friends find themselves in severe crises. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego find themselves thrown into a fiery furnace. And then, many years later, Daniel himself finds himself in a similar predicament as he gets thrown to the lions. But in both cases, they were delivered miraculously with the help of someone described either as an angel or as the son of the gods. So by the end of chapter 6, we've swept through probably around 70 years of history. But what we see time and time again is one common theme. Whatever things may look like, God is working his purposes out. Whether it's being sent into exile or being forced to eat the king's food and wine or being threatened with execution in one way or another, God has always delivered. And what's even more important than this is that the living God has been revealed to those with eyes to see him. So that's the big picture of these first six chapters. And as we go into chapter 7, we can see two very clear pointers that now we're moving into new territory for the rest of the book. Firstly, we find ourselves heading not forwards in time, but backwards. Because we're told in verse 1, we're now in the first year of Belshazzar. Now, if you can remember back to a few months ago, you might remember him as the guy who we saw in chapter 5, getting a very nasty shock when a human hand started writing on the wall in the middle of a fairly wild party. So clearly we're now on to a different progression of time in chapters 7 to 12 than we've been on in chapters 1 to 6. So that's the first thing to notice. Then the second thing is that Daniel's no longer interpreting the dreams of others, because he's now dreaming dreams himself. And what we'll see as we head through the next few weeks is a series of dreams and visions, all of them given to Daniel. And these dreams and visions seem to build on one another. And what they do is they appear to show us, in symbolic language, what's going to unfold in the rest of human history. So chapter 7 clearly marks the start of a new phase in the book. But at the same time, it's also totally tied to the first half of the book. Why do I say that? Well, having told you not to get too bogged down in the details, I want to refer you back to what at first glance looks like the most obscure detail you could possibly care to look at. If you turn back to the chapter 2, the bottom of chapter 2 footnote, it's page 885 in my Bible. So if you look at the footnote there under chapter 2, bottom of the first column, it points out that from chapter 2, verse 4, to the end of chapter 7, all of that is in Aramaic, not Hebrew. So you can make all sorts of guesses as to why it's in Aramaic, but fundamentally what this shows us is that chapter 7 is linked in a special way to chapters 2 to 6. So it goes backwards as well as forward. What's the link? Well, what's chapter 7 about? At its heart, it's a dream of four kingdoms. Now, cast your mind back to chapter 2 if you were there. Can you remember that far back? What was it about? It was a dream of four kingdoms. Now think about chapters 3 and 6. Chapter 3 was about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace. And chapter 6, Daniel in the lion's den. Separate incidents, but both examples of God's deliverance in a miraculous way. And then finally, chapters 4 and 5, both about the fate of kings. In one case, Nebuchadnezzar, puffed up and proud, but ultimately confessing Daniel's God as the King of Heaven. And as a result of that, his kingdom was restored to him. And then on the other, Belshazzar, summoning the goblets taken from the Temple of Jerusalem, and in doing so, drinking judgments upon himself. And that very night, he was overthrown by the Medes. So what we've got here is a structure that sets the events in a specific, symmetrical order. It's something called a chiastic structure. And when this happens, the aim is generally to highlight the points in the middle. So in this case, we're talking about chapters 4 and 5. So yes, we've seen that the big picture of the first half of the book is that God's working his purposes out, whatever it may look like. But this link between chapters 2 to 7 adds an extra dimension because it points to the question posed by chapters 4 and 5. And it's not just any old question, it's the most important question that any of us can ever face. Because you see, the thing is, it's not enough to observe that there's a God at work in the universe. The real question is, how are you going to respond? Will you be like Nebuchadnezzar and turn towards him? Or will you be like Belshazzar and turn your back on him? So there it is, the key question that faces every one of us. Are we going to yield to God or aren't we? And it hits us right between the eyes when we look at the framework of how chapter 7 fits in with the rest of the book. So that's a lot of background, but it's important to grasp how it all fits in. Now moving on to the detail. Well, hopefully you pieced a fair bit of it together as we read it to you earlier. What's happening is Daniel has a pretty disturbing dream as the winds of heaven stir up four beasts from the sea. And then in the middle of all this, we then have a court scene. And this court scene features someone called the Ancient of Days. Then running in parallel to this court scene, there are two sorts of sub-pictures, I guess you call them, which compare and contrast. On the one hand, this boastful little horn, and then on the other, someone described as a son of man, or literally we're told it's a human being in the footnotes if you read those. Thankfully, though, we don't have to get too confused by the details, because in verses 17 and 18, we're told that the four beasts are four earthly kingdoms. These kingdoms won't last forever, though, because only one kingdom will last forever, and that kingdom is the one which will be received by the people who are described as the holy people of the Most High. Now, things then move on a stage in verses 19 to 22 with Daniel intrigued by the rather different-looking fourth kingdom. But actually, the explanation in verses 23 to 27 is still ultimately the same. Don't worry, Daniel. The court will sit, the horn's power will be removed, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under heaven will again be handed to the holy people of the Most High. So that really is the story in a nutshell. You can drill down into the detail a bit more, and it's as you look do that, it's highly probable that the four kingdoms are meant to parallel the four kingdoms of Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2. And there are plenty of other good reasons to suggest that the lion with the eagle, the wings of an eagle represents Babylon, and the leopard represents the Greek kingdom of Alexander the Great. So if you know your history, you can make pretty good assumptions as to what the other beasts may represent. And if you want to look at it, the commentaries, the internet, they can keep you busy for hours looking at all the details. So do feel free to go away and do that if you're interested in it. But I'd rather spend the few minutes that we've got left in looking at the two key pictures that are given to us here. And these two pictures are absolutely fundamental for us to grasp if we're going to make sense of history and of the world in general as it evolves around us. So there's two pictures here. The first picture is the court scene. Because it's impossible to look at this without an entirely different court scene coming to mind. A kangaroo court, which was assembled in Jerusalem 500 or 600 years later at Passover. This one didn't appear to have the Ancient of Days as judge. And the one on trial didn't appear to be the boastful little horn. But if you ever wondered why, when Jesus said, "From now on, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven," why this should cause such consternation that the high priest tore his clothes and condemned him for blasphemy, then you need wonder no more, because the answer's right here in this passage. Because what's happening is that Jesus is claiming that he's this Son of Man that we see here in Daniel 7. He's the one who's fit to approach the Ancient of Days. The one who'll be given authority, glory, and sovereign power. And all nations and peoples of every language will worship him. And he's the one whose kingdom will never be destroyed. So that's quite a claim. And you can quite understand why the high priest declared it as blasphemy. But of course, it's only blasphemy if it isn't true. And if what he says is true, then suddenly this court scene in Jerusalem is completely flipped on its head. Because what you see then is that Jesus isn't ultimately the person on trial at all. It's the high priest and all those gathered there. They're the ones really on trial. Because you see, Jesus knows exactly who he is. He's going to have authority, glory, and sovereign power for eternity. The problem is, the high priests and the others, they're just blind to that reality. They're the ones really on trial. Do they see it? And of course, that same trial is being played out time and time again throughout all ages for all of humanity. You know, we're back to chapters 4 and 5 again, Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar. Will we recognize Jesus as this Son of Man and turn towards God, the Father, the Ancient of Days? Or will we be totally blind to who Jesus really is, just like the high priest, and condemn him as a fraud? It's the challenge facing every human being who's ever lived. So this critical question stares us in the face as we look at the court scene. But of course, as Christians, we can also take the most incredible comfort from this scene. Because we're told clearly, verses 18, 22, and 27, that the holy people of the Most High will inherit the everlasting kingdom. The people who belong to Jesus, those who turn to him and put their trust in him, they will receive this everlasting kingdom. It's astounding, absolutely astounding. We will inherit this everlasting kingdom as Christians. Whatever gets thrown at us, whatever things may feel like, this is reality. We will inherit the everlasting kingdom. So that's the first picture that we need to grasp, and we need to allow it to be driven deep down into us. This picture of the court scene, it provides the most extraordinary assurance for those of us who put their trust in Jesus. And yet there's also a second picture here in this chapter that we need to look at. And this one isn't anywhere near as comforting to the Christian, because it's a picture of a battle. And this picture also comes with a very obvious question, because if the world to come is going to be inherited by the people who belong to Jesus, then how can this world be such a difficult place? And the answer is, it's all down to the horns. Yes, eternity does belong to Jesus, but we're not yet in eternity. Jesus has opened the door so that those who turn to him will be counted as his people. But in the meantime, a battle with earthly kingdoms is being fought. And you just have to look at the language that Daniel uses to realize that these earthly kingdoms can be pretty frightening. Because, you know, you may have thought that at the end of a dream where he realizes that it's all going to be okay in the end, that Daniel would wake up feeling fairly happy, but not a bit of it. Verse 28 says he was deeply troubled and his face turned pale. And of course, the beast that frightened Daniel the most was this last beast. He describes it as the most terrifying, with its iron teeth and bronze claws. And of course, it's out of this beast that all these horns came, of which the worst seems to be this boastful little horn. Now, there's an incredibly strong argument that this particular horn in question refers to the Antichrist himself, but it's clearly one in a long line of horns. And we're told that these horns do one thing above all else. They oppose God's people. But it's not just that, because in verse 21, we're told that this little horn wasn't just waging war against the holy people. He was actually defeating them. So it's no wonder that Daniel's face turned pale. Eternity may belong to Jesus, but in the meantime, the battle rages. And sometimes God's people will be defeated. So that's why we hear about our Christian brothers and sisters around the world being persecuted or even martyred for their faith. It shouldn't be a surprise. We're in a battle. Equally, that's why we find attitudes in this country hardening against Orthodox Christian beliefs. We're in a battle. It shouldn't be a surprise. And actually, you know, we should be incredibly thankful that in this country we still have the freedom to share our faith in a way that others around the world can't. And it's really important that we use these opportunities wisely, because history and the book of Daniel says that it won't always be that way. So captured here in the two pictures that we see of the court scene and the battle are things which help us to make ultimate sense of the world that we live in. Eternity belongs to Jesus. Judgment's already been pronounced. But in the here and now, as God works his purposes out, we're in a battleground. And what we'll see in the coming weeks, as we look through the rest of the book of Daniel, is this being played out time and time again as we see things working through in greater depth. But that's for next week.